Hello, I'd say ladies and gentlemen, but it's like 99% gentlemen that watch me. So, you know, thanks to like the three women who are in my audience. It's great. I appreciate you. But it's Friday night. We've got episode 110 of The Naturalist Capitalist. I am, of course, your host, Reed Coverdale, as always. And I think this is his fourth appearance on the show. We've got Will Fight, and you've seen him on Fight Night, but never by himself. So we've got him here solo. How's it going tonight, Will?
That's going pretty well. You were asking me when I wanted to do this. I was like, yeah, give me like an hour and a half. Yeah, I I've been reading Jose Canseco's book because why not? I need some random reading in my life about steroids and sports and Madonna, I guess. But anyway, I fell asleep while reading it. So I was like, oh, shit, I need to give me a second. And I did get myself together. I hadn't eaten. And it's like you're like behind me by 2 hours. So it's 9 for you. It's like 11 for me. I realized it was like 10:30 and I hadn't eaten. I was like, I need to eat something before I go on this.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, we always have fun conversations on Fight Night. It's kind of, I mean, it goes from World War One history to controversial racial topics to, I mean, it just kind of like goes wherever the wind takes us. And we do everything within the confines of not getting banned on YouTube, which is still pretty broad. Like, I mean, it is annoying what you can get banned for, but when you think about it, it is still kind of broad. But tonight, since we just got you, we're going to talk a little bit more about Will Fight. Who is the man, Will Fight, that causes so much laughter for everybody? What is his story? So tell us a little bit about Will Fight. I know you did actually the first episode, but what was your household like that you grew up in, and where did you live, and what was your belief system? Just give us the lowdown, man.
Yeah. So, my dad, well, really both my parents are, but my dad was born in Iowa. My family in Iowa has been there for like 150 years. I think there's one cemetery where you can just go back and you can find everything. So a lot of the, ideology in my family is just hard blue collar workers. My dad was the first person in our family to go to college. My mom had people in her family go to college, but my dad was the first in his. And so it was kind of, I want to say it was traditional kind of America conservative, two parent nuclear family household. It kind of was like that, but there's a little bit more nuance to that. My dad and probably my grandparents, his parents, only like conservatives in our family. Everyone else is like FDR Democrats up there, at least of my grandma's generation. So the rest, like their kids are Democrats and that, so on and so on. But my dad was a Republican, and I've never asked him when he became one, but he just always just kind of like, yeah, I just thought liberals were kind of dumb. I was just like, fair enough. My dad's a hardworking guy, and he went to school. He went and got a master's degree. I used to say growing up, my dad was the first person to go to college, so he went twice to make up for everyone else. He works in college athletics, so I was around sports a lot growing up, and I still love sports. I'm wearing a sports hat right now, but
a gym hat.
Yeah, I didn't wear the gym hat this time. I don't even know where that is. I usually, when I take that off, I usually throw it somewhere across my apartment and I just don't find it. And then I'll just randomly pull it out and I'm like, oh yeah, my gym hat. And I'll wear it for like a day and then forget it again.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I was around sports a lot. I played sports. I played baseball and football growing up. It really was. Like, I hate to be as stereotypical as it sounds, but it was like, oh yeah, I played sports and my parents are conservatives and blah, 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 1950s Americana BS. But so I was born in Kansas City. I moved from Kansas City when I was 3 to Indianapolis. From there, I was only there for about a year. I moved to Houston, Texas. So I spent 10 years in Houston and I lived in Oklahoma for 10 years. So I had this weird hodgepodge of regional identity. And with that comes like a really interesting outlook on things. I have a very Midwestern view of the world, with my parents being from Iowa and identifying with that for a long time of my, like a majority of my life. I remember in elementary school, we were learning about the Civil War. And I was like, "Ha, I'm from Kansas originally, so you guys lost." And the Texans did not like that at all, which it's just funny now because I don't even identify myself as a Northerner anymore after 20 years in Texas and Oklahoma. But it's just it's kind of funny. So it's a weird little thing where I've experienced Northern ideology and life. I know Midwestern life. I've known Southern life, well, Texas Southern, which is completely different from the Deep South, which not a lot of people realize. And then I've, you know, got it a mixture of the Midwest and Texas Southern and Oklahoma. And so it's really interesting. A lot of weird, like, combinations are up here in my dome of just how the world is. You know, you learn a lot when I moved to Houston as a kid, I was roughly 4 years old. And we were living in this apartment in Houston when we were looking for our house was being built. So we're living in this like downtown Houston apartment. We were like the only people that spoke English. It was nothing but it was a majority of them were like immigrant families. They were Latino. They were Arabic. They were everything. Being from you know raised by Northern parents, it wasn't like anything where you There's a thing in the South where even if your parents aren't racist, there's still a big understanding of, well, you got to be careful. The Mexican family is over here. Or you got to be careful. It's like a lot of ingrained racism. We didn't really have any of that. So I grew up like I have a vague memory of like a kid who was like across the hall or something. And he didn't speak English, but we were just like. Smile at each other and like it was like, hey, we're both kids, maybe we can be friends. We don't speak each other's languages. And so then I lived in Pearland, Texas, and Ron Paul is my congressman throughout my childhood.
Yeah, so
of
right.
course that'll really affect you. I didn't know a lot about Ron until he ran for president, but it's like you go and you realize, hey, he's from where I'm from. And like his daughter lived down the street from me with her and her kid, her family. They lived down the street from me for about 3 years before I moved to Oklahoma. So I always thought that was really cool. And that's when Rand was starting to get going. Cause I actually, now that I recall it was like, that's Ron Paul's daughter. Like my parents were like, oh, that's really cool. Like, isn't there a son too? I said, yeah, he's like a doctor in Kentucky.
Yeah.
And that was before he ran for Senate. So I just thought that was really interesting. But so, yeah, that's kind of where I come from, just based on where I'm from and how I kind of came to be who I am. I have a really weird mixture of identity. Yeah. I like to say I'm American to a lot of people. Like, dude, I've been everywhere. I've lived everywhere. I'm not Northern. I'm not Southern. My family's from the North. I primarily lived in the South. It's kind of funny. So my dad's family, been in Iowa for 150 years. My mom's family, she was born in Dallas. During quarantine last year, she went and traced back both of our families completely. Her family's almost been exclusively in the South for majority of the existence of the colonial world over here, and then my dad's family in the North. So it's like a mixture of the two, and it's a really, really interesting dynamic of I've got like a grandfather. My mom's dad is super, he's like this big lawyer down in Oklahoma City, like a big dude, just like, hey, talks like this. And I'm, you know, he shuffles around, he sounds super Southern, and he's from Texas, and he lived out in West Texas. And then you have my grandma up in Iowa, who's just this short, tiny little old lady who lived on a farm for her entire life. And it's just really, it's a really interesting dynamic. You see two different sides of America depending on who I'm seeing on a holiday.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird. When you're saying that deal about how you didn't grow up with like racism or compartmentalization of people, I grew up in New Hampshire, and New Hampshire is like 99% white, I think. And I honestly didn't know anyone that wasn't white till I went to high school, and then I knew like two people because I lived in a town that had 4,000 people, had 120 kids in the high school. I think there was one black kid and then one Asian kid, or maybe like three Asian kids. There were not, it was not diverse. So it's just something we really didn't think about at all. Like, it's just something I never ever thought about. It was funny, like my first exposure to racial diversity or whatever was a roofing company in Denver with a bunch of Mexicans and a bunch of black guys and a bunch of Asians. And, you know, there were people from Somalia, people from Burma, people from Mexico, Guatemala, like all over the place. You want to talk about like the most racially insensitive place you could ever be is on that roof. Like, it was just, I mean, like I would, you know, I have a very fucked up sense of humor, but I would not laugh at some of the jokes that they were making to each other just because I still like was a little bit afraid that they'd stab me and throw me off the roof or something. I'm a white guy. So I just like, whoa. But yeah, it is like, I don't know if it's a privilege growing up that way, like just not having to deal with that. But I mean, either way, I'm glad that it's something I don't think about. Like, I mean, I know people who grew up in, actually in Texas. One of the guys that I was good friends with at the roofing company there, he was a black guy, and he said the Mexicans and the black guys hated each other at the schools he went to, and he got shot seven times,
Jesus,
in the abdomen area, and he survived. So I mean, he got over that. You know, he was able to work with a bunch of Mexicans and get along with them on the roof and everything. But I think that plays a big role. Like, however you're brought up and whatever your mindset is as a kid, it seems like it's easier to move forward in life than if you are brought up with some bullshit, or if you're raised in a town where there is that division between races or whatever. It seems like that would be a lot harder to overcome.
Yeah, it's funny you bring up the humor aspect of it. It's like growing up, racial humor was everywhere, but we didn't look at it within the terms of racism. We just looked at it in the terms of we're all different and we can make fun of that. And that was a really weird to hear now, because you can't do that now. Right. Everything's changed. I tweeted something about that today. I said about how, do you remember like right after Occupy Wall Street, the media started telling you about racism all the time, and it was because they wanted to distract us from the elites and everything. So in those, because I was seriously thinking about it, I was like, I remember having a diverse group of friends growing up. Like, I played football with this Mexican kid. His name was Jared, and he lived like, my mom would always call it the barrio. That's probably a little bit racist to her, but she didn't mean anything by it. And they would invite me to come over, and I went to their, you know, their neighborhood. By neighborhood, it was like apartment complexes type deal. Like, you'd imagine, you know, in a city. I was in Houston, and me and a couple other white kids went over there, and we were just hanging out with a bunch of Mexican kids. And you would never see that today. Seriously believe you would never see that today. And it's a shame, because I think we've regressed a lot in the last 20 years.
And they, you know, everyone was trying to blame that on Obama, and I think it's really unfair. I don't think it's one man's fault. I think it's a societal push that we've gone through with, it seems to have a lot to do with academia, mm-hmm. You know, like a lot with, it seems to have a lot to do with college. And a new narrative. I wouldn't blame. I mean, it's so dumb when, you know, when people are running for president and they're always talking about like, I'm going to unify the country. It's like, okay. I mean, one guy, sure. Go for it. You can try. Or, I mean, I just feel like we put so much stress on that when there's so many other factors playing into it.
I think a lot of it has to do with, this is going to make me sound like Steven Crowder because he did a video on it, but it's affirmative action and quotas, hiring quotas. And you stop looking at people. Like, I'm not saying, you know, people of color got jobs over white people because of their color, which, I mean, it does happen, but it's not, I would rather, it's bad for the people of color, I feel, because instead of being hired for their abilities, they're hired because of what they look like. And it's like a weird, to me, because this is just an honest to God opinion. This isn't based on anything I've read or anything. It's just, it seems like a weird little pseudo racism, but also it's like it's been flipped. So it used to be, I didn't hire you because of the color of your skin. Now I'm going to hire you for the color of your skin.
Right.
I don't care what you can do. Just go sit in a corner, basically, or try to do the work. And the leftist ideology when it comes to race has become so patronizing, at least from white liberals, I feel like.
Yeah.
Towards black people, towards Hispanics, like the videos you saw flying around after the Georgia voter law and everything about how like kids and like it was like Cal Berkeley are talking about how it's racist to have to make people show their IDs. It's racist towards black people, and the people are like, why? It's like, well, they might not know how to get one. And it's like, you fucking realize how fucked up you're trying to be an ally to them, and in reality, you just sound like a bigot from the deep south and like the Jim Crow era.
Exactly.
Just give them a slap a southern accent on them, and it turns into, well, you know, they don't know how to get their identification, so yeah. We can't make them. These are simple people. It's just like that's what it turns into. You just lack the accent, and you just turn it into a more pompous one, and it's the same thing. I saw someone say this once. It's white liberals are more racist than conservatives are, except. But the major difference is they feel so guilty about it. In reality, they show it more under the guise of trying to help. It's like they're so internally racist, then they feel guilty about it, so they want to use that racism to think that they're doing good. The white savior complex, really, it's crazy, and it's just a reality. I mean, I don't know how we're gonna get rid of it. I think I'm not going to, you know, say critical race theory is the reason. I mean, I don't know. I don't know enough about critical race theory to really make that claim. I think about a year ago I would have made it because I was stupid and just making random claims to get Twitter clout. I mean, I did think it, but I wouldn't make that claim now. I think critical race theory is dangerous from what I know about it, but it just doesn't help. I think it's another tool of division more than it is a tool of making us all realize that we're just, I hate to use this cliche, we're all part of one race, the human race. Like it's true though, but
it is true. But instead of making it a bigger collective, like the human race, I try to bring it down to the individual all the time. Like that's really what I see the solution to this problem being is, you know, not judging someone whether they're a guy or a girl or a black, white, Asian, Hispanic, whatever, like just judge them based on their own merits. And it's really weird because that's what Martin Luther King said. You know, I'm going to butcher this quote, but I dream of a day when a man can be judged by the content of his character instead of the color of his skin or whatever. Like,
I don't think you butchered that. I think that's exactly what he said.
It's exactly the meaning of what he said.
It's the meaning.
And you're right. Like, we've gotten to the point where a lot of people are pushing for the color of your skin to matter more than the content of your character. Like, one of the greatest examples of that is, like, instead of fixing, you know, police brutality, we're going to hire a black sheriff. Like, okay. Like, what does that do? It's
while
like
you're black, he's still an agent of the state that's going to hurt you. What do you
like? Or like, you know, the CIA, you saw the woke CIA ad, right?
I didn't watch it. I saw the comments on it. I was like, I'm not even gonna waste my time.
Like, dude, it's so cringe. But that's what they do now. Like, that's fixing the problem. You make a transgender drone pilot, and it's like, oh, cool. Like, that's
the all gay helicopter team by the Navy.
Yeah, I mean, dude, like, stuff we were memeing last year is reality now. It's insane. Like, it's just coming together before our eyes.
The funny thing is, I just don't think they care anymore. They're just tired. They don't even want to hide it anymore. It's like. My favorite thing about the Navy, the helicopter thing, is like, you guys really think that's the first all gay Navy helicopter crew?
Yeah, you don't realize the entire Navy's gay yet.
Now, you guys must not be around the Navy very often. I had an uncle that was in the Navy. I'm sure that would get me in trouble. I have a friend who's in the Navy too.
I was best man at a guy's wedding who is in the Navy, and I'd make the Navy jokes all the time around him. So it is what it is.
Everyone does. It's like telling Marines that they eat crayons.
Yeah, exactly, dude. Like, that's what's so funny, that they actually made that ad unironically, though. It's just hilarious. The all gay Navy helicopter. Like, it's just like, oh man, that's just hilarious. But you're right, they're getting lazy. Like, I've been talking about this a lot, not just with the woke stuff, but with like authoritarianism. Like, their blatant calls for tying vaccination status to reopening states or whatever, and they're not hiding it anymore. They're just becoming more and more belligerent all the time, and that gives me a little bit of hope that they're that dumb, because even a crayon eater can look at that and be like, oh yeah, this isn't right. Like, something's wrong. You know, this is not normal. This isn't natural. Where a couple of years ago, it was a little harder to see that, maybe.
Since we're on the topic of being lazy, the obvious pushing of, you know, you've heard about I can't remember what it was, but they, Biden pretty much money to help push basically propaganda about getting people to take the vaccine. You know how lazy it's gotten?
Yeah. $6 billion or something for vaccine marketing or something.
Yeah. Like, so I've been watching baseball a lot lately, because it's, you know, it's baseball season started off and it's fun to watch. But anyway, there's a Sam Adams commercial and it's just blatant propaganda. And they have an advertising campaign where it's your cousin from Boston, and it's just a guy who's clearly from Southie. He's got that generic, like, stereotypical Boston or South Boston accent, and he goes and gets his vaccine, and he passes out because of the needle, and then they give it to him. But the nurse in the commercial, when she gives it to him, goes, "Oh, you passed out when you saw the needle. Here you go, but continue to wear your mask." And I was like, "Why are you putting that in there? Why? That's clear. It's so she has a mask on, so you can't see her face. So it's like clearly overdubbed, and it's just like, what are you guys doing, Sam Adams?
So it's
government
just
give you some money.
Yeah, this is the government at work again. They can't even make convincing ads if they have to.
Man, so I. For those people who are watching or later watch and don't realize what I do, I'm a regional director with the National Association for Gun Rights, and basically I'm a gun lobbyist. I'm like those evil people that Bloomberg tells you about.
Want children to die.
Yeah, I'm terrible. One legislative session here in Indiana, I saw how fucking inept government is, even at our state levels. Like, oh my. One of my people inside who I work with, and they're like, you know, we spent like 2 hours today doing, and I was like, what? Said, well, we commemorated a plaque, and we made popcorn the official snack of Indiana. That's what we did today. Taxpayer money, hard at work. It's like, and we can't even get a. In this meanwhile, our constitutional carry bill was just hanging out, not doing anything. And it's just like, you people don't care. The political class does not care about people. They never have, and they will continue not to. And it doesn't surprise me anymore. It used to, but I was a naive person. Like, that's one thing I will give COVID and its lockdown some credit. it showed a lot of people who were on the edge of hating the government enough as it was to realizing, oh, y'all really, really do suck.
Yeah.
There is a reason not to trust you people.
Yeah, so hey, I've never really talked to you about this, but are you an anarchist yet? And I say yet because I feel like you are going to be if you're not yet. But what where are you on that stage?
So I always say I am a I'm a minarchist in practice, mainly because in a perfect world I would be an anarchist because I think I just want to I what I want to do is just go live off the grid in Montana and not talk to anybody ever again and only interact with people I choose to
Right.
have a covenant community. That's something I want to do with people I care about, and we all agree on the terms of our little space, and that's what we do. So yeah, I guess in that sense, yeah, I am an anarchist then. But I realized about 6 months ago, I'm a pragmatic minarchist, that's what I say, because I realized that the state exists, and while it exists, I'm going to do my best to make it smaller.
That's
And it's the, because trust me, I would love to be one of the, anarchists out there that just don't give a shit about the government and what it does, and you just go live off in your own world and talk about Mises and Rothbard all day, and Hoppe, and my Hoppian friends love talking about Hoppe all day, and like even that, some of their conversations are over my head when I'm just like, I love what you guys talk about, I really do. And I was talking to them a lot around January and February. The Hoppians, I love those guys. I said before, they're really nice. They get a bad rap because of helicopter memes.
Right.
But they just absolutely despise the state and they just don't want anything to do with it. I found I couldn't agree with them on that a lot because one, because of my job. My job has me interacting with the state a lot.
Right.
But also it exists. You guys sitting in a, and this goes for any anarchist group on Twitter. You guys sitting in a DM all day just bitching about the government and thinking the state is stupid. You guys aren't doing anything about it.
Right.
So trying to make it smaller, it's like it's the pathway to getting your ANCAP paradise. I mean, there's even people in the liberty community that hate ANCAPs too, but that's just the term I'm going to use. Your little anarcho-capitalist paradise you want so bad, that's not just going to show up. Like everyone, when January 6th happened, everyone was like, "Oh, here it is! It's the end! All right, guys, let's go!" And it's just like, "What the fuck are you guys gonna go do?
Yeah,
All
we
I know,
got
all y'all work 9 to 5s. You don't live on a farm anywhere. None of you know how to grow crops. You guys really gonna go do this now?" And it's just, and you just get a lot of people just realizing, "Oh, fuck, we don't know what we're doing."
Yeah, I mean, we got more government out of that. Like, if you look at it, I mean, there's the fence is still up in Washington, right? The National Guard's still there. Have they actually?
Yeah, they're still there. Like
Yeah.
I've talked to our guys in DC about it, and they said, yeah, it's like nearly impossible to get a meeting with anybody anymore. And it's
Yeah.
just like it's anyone who claims to be an intellectual of any sort that was celebrating when January 6th happened in the sense that they thought that this was the beginning of the end clearly haven't read a fucking history book
Right.
because in no con that's like I hate to say it. It's such a cliche example. That was the Reichstag fire. That's
Yeah.
exactly what that was. That was a, and I hate to use the fascist communist, comparison, but it's true, And
Although
I don't,
it was the other way, the
yeah.
this time the communists were burning it and blaming it on the Nazis instead of the other way around,
Yeah,
so.
and well, here's the thing. I think a lot of it had, I love that the FBI and like the CIA were like, well, Antifa and leftist groups, they weren't there. Like, oh yeah, are you the same CIA that says you had no ties to the cocaine trade?
Right.
Like I have no doubt in my mind there were Antifa and other leftist groups blending in with the crowd there. Come on.
This CIA, it's so funny, like what we can, or just the intelligence agencies in general, that the left and the right will both hate them and love them subjectively. So throughout the entire investigation of Russiagate and Ukrainegate, the right hated the intelligence agencies. And then as soon as we airstriked Soleimani, it was like, oh no, these guys knew that we had imminent, you know, information of an imminent attack and we had to do something. It's like, okay, who was providing that information? The same intelligence agencies you've been railing against for like the last 3.5 months. And they were like, oh yeah, well, whatever. And then, you know, the Democrats are the same way. Like they love it when it's on their side, and it has been lately. And then, you know, once, I don't know, it's just, it's mind boggling. There's no consistency whatsoever.
Here's an interesting thing about that. You know, people in our circles, you know, the Liberty Movement people, Liberty Twitter especially, they like to look at, you know, Democrats and Republicans, you know, just average people who say stuff about how much, like Trump supporters who do the deep state. And then when Trump loses, it's, we need the deep state to help us and shit like that. A Q. And it's just like, everyone loves to make fun of both Democrats and Republicans for being dumb. And I used to, there was a point there I was like, yeah, I was getting that way. I've kind of walked that back. I think a lot of people, both Republicans and Democrats, just average people, even the people who you see on Twitter threads, just, I still stand with Donald Trump or Joe Biden is doing great. Mm-hmm. They're just normal people who are scared because life is fucking terrifying in reality. And the way American politics has seemed since like 2015 has just been high pressure constantly. And they just want someone to save them because I think a lot of people realize that if everything came crashing down, a majority of people are fucked. And like, I think people like in our movement, well, there are even people, yeah, in our movement that bow down to Dave Smith as a savior, yeah, and they bow down to Amash as a savior. Yeah. Then they're just normal people who are fucking scared and just want someone to feel protected either by government or just by ideology.
Yeah, dude, and I think that's bad. I mean, that's why.
Well, yeah, it's very bad, but it's just the reality. I call them IQ 90s. Wow. But it's like IQ 90 people are just like, they're fucking scared, man. And we didn't used to be that way. 9/11 changed everything, you know. I hate to bring it all back to 9/11, but it's true, you know. It was started before then. It started in the Cold War. Then the Cold War was really the beginning of it, of the whole, we need to be protected by a state. And when the Cold War ended, we didn't have anyone to blame as our enemy anymore. And which is funny because that's a key characteristic of fascism, of you always need an enemy. So yeah. I hate calling either the Democrats or Republican fascist too, because I think it's so fucking cliche. They're authoritarian. Fascism are just completely. Yeah, Evan Freshwater is very right. Fascism is, in reality, I don't think we won't see it in the context of people like to point to, like, Trump's a fascist, look at what Mussolini and Hitler did. You're not going to see that fascism anymore. That's never going to happen. It's just authoritarianism. It's just big government. And
well, the thing is,
labeling it like that is just kind of redundant. It doesn't matter.
Well, the problem is with fascism, you know, it's really, it comes down to economics. Like the original definition of fascism is merging of corporation and state. Mm-hmm. And a lot of people put social aspects to both communism and fascism. They don't think about the economic structure at all. Like when they think communism, they think Antifa breaking windows, you know, red flags and black boots or whatever. And then fascism is brown shirts and racism, and, you know, like,
ironically more red flags, but
yeah, more red flags. Yeah. It's very similar at the, it's the horseshoe theory, but, with fascism, a lot of people are just talking about it when they have no idea what it is. You know, a lot of people who are screaming Trump is a fascist is because he says mean words on television about the press. And, you know, that's fascism in their minds. Or he says something racist about Mexicans, so that's fascism. Where the literal fascism that has happened that has been happening for decades, but really went into nuclear mode the last year. You know, it was all these giant corporate bailouts and destroying small businesses and putting more and more regulations on the economy. And, you know, that's literal fascism, but we've cheapened the word so much that it doesn't mean anything anymore.
Yeah, so, in a way, I think that's always been like the goal, is to make those words be less meaningful. So when fascism really shows up, people won't be able to identify it because that's fascism.
Yeah. What was I going to say? This is actually, a lot of people get upset at me, but it's why I go so hard on religion I don't even do it that much. I think it's like a tenth of what I talk about maybe, but I think it all ties in. Like, we have this need for stability and security and appeal to an authority figure to save us. I mean, it's really exactly what you pointed out, and people are always looking for it. And, you know, sometimes people who are religious are looking for it in their faith, but they're also looking for it in their normal life through politics or, you know, heroes in media or whatever. I think that ideology is just really bad. The idea that you need someone to save you, you know,
it is. No one's coming to save you
in that way. But
I think in a spiritual sense, because I'm not going to, you know, be critical of people's religion. I think religion is important to a lot of people. It's not as, I am privately religious, but I don't talk about it because it's no one's business other than mine. It's my relationship with God or a God or whatever.
Right.
I'm Norse pagan. No, I'm just kidding. me and Odin are pretty tight. No, anyway. I don't have any problem with people, you know, my Jesus is my savior, stuff like that.
Well, let me clarify before you keep going. Like, I think there's a difference between personal faith and religion. Like, if you believe something sincerely or whatever, like, I don't expect everyone to believe the same thing I do. When I say religion, I mean like these organized groups that want you to think a certain way and want you to believe certain things. And
yeah. That's where I was going. I was going to say they've turned government and the political parties of the Republicans and Democrats and the demagogues who lead them for short periods of time when they're, you know, president or former president, they've turned them into their religion. And they're like the gold idol of Trump, you know, it's like that. People, they look at these political figures and they go, that's my God now. They don't say it, but that's reality. It's like the Reagan worship in conservative circles, which I did it when I was in high school, when I was fucking 17 years old and stupid. But it's like, you look at these politicians as if they're your God, and it's just, they're just people. They're mortal men, and they're not going to fucking do anything to help you. It didn't start with Reagan, it was FDR. It was started with Washington. Like, if you're gonna look at it within the lens of American politics, it started with Washington and the founders. Those were the gods of American political religion. And in a way, I think it stems from the divine rule of kings, of God ordained me king.
Right.
I am. So they looked at, at their monarchs as God, in a way. You know, anyone, I think there's history, points in history where people are like,
which is
to talk bad on the king is to talk bad on God. You challenge he's not the true king. Oh, you challenge the word of God? It's like shit like that. So it comes from that.
Which I do want to interject there, because it's kind of funny, because I don't know how well you know the Bible, but. I forget if it's in Samuel, first or second Samuel, but when the Israelites want a king, and God's like, no, you don't, like, you don't want a king. And they're like, yes, we do. Give us a king. And then he's like, okay, fine. He gives them the king, and it's Saul, and he's horrible. eventually. And it just kind of, so anarchy is actually sort of biblical in a way. Like, you can tie it into the Bible if you want. The whole idea of like having a man to rule over you, God was not, he wasn't a fan of it. And he told the Israelites that they weren't going to be a fan of it either. And they were like, nope, we want it. And he was like, okay, fine. And it's just kind of funny how that transpired. But
human history is weird. I studied history all through college, and I wasn't a great historian in the terms of the way liberal academia looks at it. I don't like revisionist history. I think it's stupid. I think it's also important, but it's also stupid because they're revising it within a certain lens. If you're looking at history through the complete lens, and you look at and that's the thing. That's the thing they teach historians today when they're teaching them, is, well, that's what we're doing. We're taking the ultra conservative traditional look at things, and we're adding the other side to make it even. No, in reality, a lot of it's all, we're gonna look at things complete opposite side of everything and just fuck the other opinion completely.
Right.
There's no nuance anymore. Like, it was in a history class. It was not a survey class. It was it was preparing us to write our like 25 page thesis paper we had to write to graduate. So we had to write like a 5-page version of it. But we got in a debate one day in class, and I'm at this point, I am a libertarian, but I'm not like I am now. I was still pretty much a conservatarian. I mean, people right. still call me a conservatarian, but that's beside the point. And the instructor, he mainly taught Native American studies. And he answered the, and I love this guy. He was a great professor. He goes, you know, the main way of looking at what, you know, when pushing west and looking at Native Americans is that they were helping them because they used the term savages. He says they were technologically behind and they were living out in the woods and shit like that. And today we teach that that's a wrong look at it. And I love to play devil's advocate. And as you can see, I am a libertarian. So I love to play devil's advocate. And I go, well, could you make the argument in a sense they were right? And he was like, he could see where I was going. So he was like, explain. And I was like, they were technologically, I don't want to use the word inferior, and that's what I said, but they were behind technologically by hundreds of years, maybe even 1,000 years. And they did, Native American groups did get a lot of good out of some European inventions. Like, firearms made their lives a lot easier when it came to hunting, stuff like that. Also made their lives worse with westward expansion. But you could make the argument that European introduction of tools and, you know, buildings, while the nomadic tribes suffered the most, the tribes who were just very much just by themselves in one place permanently, they did benefit from European colonization. To an extent. And I said, and my point ultimately was, I think it's important to look at that in regards to like the Quakers up north. They interacted with Native American tribes up in, you know, New England for a long time. And a lot of them didn't have any issues, and they all lived side by side and everything was all hunky dory until, you know, the rest of us showed up. But my ultimate point here is I think it's important to look at history with nuance and looking at everything. And that's not the way they teach it anymore. They teach it looking at all colonization was bad. And I was like, that's just not true. A lot of it was pretty violent and bad. But, like, there was retaliations towards Europeans, and Europeans retaliated back. And that's just human history, though. And I hate the whole... I'm going on a random tangent. I hate the whole America is a conquered land and we need to give it back or whatever. And that's human history. The whole notion and the way they kind of teach it now is, well, Native Americans lived here in North America in harmony and peace and everyone loved each other. No, no. Fuck no.
Yeah.
Like, look at the Aztecs. The Aztecs were notorious for conquering fucking everyone and then sacrificing them on pyramids. And, like, the Maya did that, too. But it's just like, guys, you guys are so caught up in trying to demonize Europeans for their past, which to an extent, this is going to piss a lot of paleos off, is fair. Human history, especially when Europeans show up to North America, is fucked up. A lot of fucked up shit happened. And if you could admit that, great. But don't, it's like you don't want to punish people for things they had no control over. Yeah. Like I am descendant of slave owners. I didn't have anything to do with slavery. Like I always tell people that I'm 0.2% West African. And it's usually a joke when I bring it up. But my point is America is such a weird place. My both sides of my family have been here for 400 years. I'm 0.2% West African. Given context, you can kind of figure out where that comes from. And I can guarantee you, not everyone was very happy about it.
Yeah. Yeah, you know what's funny is you were saying the thing about blaming people for what has happened in the past. It's interesting that a lot of the people pushing reparations and, you know, talking about how we need to give the land back or whatever, they tend to not stress at all what we're literally doing right now in Afghanistan. Like, we're still there. We just broke the deal and we're staying there 4 months longer and apparently leaving in September, you know, or what we're supporting in Israel with Palestine. You know, they don't talk about that at all. You know, it's very interesting that you're supposed to be so furious about things that you had no control over. Meanwhile, today we are still paying taxes for a government that is murdering people or assisting in murdering people overseas, like right now. So it seems like
there's no ideological consistency. It's just insane.
I mean, it seems like if you care about that should take precedence. And then, you know, maybe if we work that out, then we can talk about packing up and moving back to England or whatever, you know. Like, let's at least deal with that first, and then we can argue about the other stuff.
Well, here's another interesting way of looking at it too, and I'll use the South Africa example, the Boers in South Africa. A lot of people say, well, they need to just go back to Europe. And I was just like, I've seen people talk about that mainly because I find South Africa as a I find the whole South Africa Rhodesia thing. Everyone knows I'm interested in that. If you follow me on Twitter for a while, you know I get obsessed with Rhodesia every now and then. I tweet about it a bunch. I have a bunch of books on it. Anyway, I find it interesting. And people like to point to the Boers, and you know they should just go back to where they came from. And if they had been there for like 20 years, I'd probably agree with them. But the problem is the Boers have been in South Africa for nearly 400 years. That's the only world those people know. They're as African in regards, or South African than people who've lived there for thousands of years. And they don't know anything else. And that's how it is for Americans. People, like I said, my family's been here since, I'm descendant of the second governor of the Massachusetts colony. I don't know Europe. I don't want to live in Europe because Europe's not where I'm from. That's not where my family has lived for 400 years. The great American experiment of the melting pot is important because, and I hate to sound like a globalist here, Alex Jones is going to hate me, but
globalism is good. It's just not the
if we're going to ever get along. And we're ever going to, you want equality and you want that. If you really want equality and you really want people to not be racist anymore, you need to be okay with people living together and understanding that we had a very violent history and past. But if at the end of the day, if me and I went to, you know, if I can go down to the Mexican restaurant that the menu is only in Spanish and just sit down and casually hang out and have something to eat and just be vibing, that's fine. But there's too many people on both sides that don't want that to happen. And it's like, why?
Right.
Like, that's so dumb. And I don't know. I could talk about this forever. And I hate race discussions, mainly because you get down rabbit holes of just talking about race, and you always find one person who wants to say one is better than the other. Not that either one of us are going to do that because we're fucking smarter than that.
Right.
But I guess on that note, I'll tell a fun little story. On I infiltrated white nationalist Twitter for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
I created a fake name. Ironically, the name was the last name on the account was a Rosenberg. So Odin Rosenberg, that was my fake white nationalist name, which so many people were fucking dumb and didn't realize that I had picked an extremely Jewish last name. Some people did, and they were like, isn't Rosenberg a Jewish name? And I was like, what? No, it's a strong Aryan name. What are you talking about? And fucking people were dumb and just accepted it. But I ended up in like a the Gypsy Crusader. He was the guy who dressed up as the Joker and would go on like Omegle and to say the N-word a bunch. I ended up in his Telegram group because I was interested. You know, you hear nothing but three, four years of white nationalists are, you know, they're plotting. And I was like, let's see what they're doing. All those guys do all day is argue about who's more white. Like, you would go in there and I would just read through things and be like, you guys argued if Hungarians are white enough for like 30 minutes. Like, what the you guys aren't doing anything. You guys aren't plotting anything. The guys who are plotting things are like four guys in a shed in rural Tennessee. You guys are just 15-year-olds on the internet who are pissed off that you have to learn critical race theory and you don't know how to fucking think for yourselves yet. So you just go to collectivist ideology. And it's just so fucking stupid. And also that guy, Gypsy Crusader, got arrested and he's looking at like 60 years in prison. So I definitely have an FBI file with an alias, Odin Rosenberg somewhere. And I can't wait for the day that comes up.
Yeah, they got plenty of other reasons to link it to you for other internet crimes you've committed recently. So, yeah.
Like drinking 20 beers on a live stream and fucking dying.
It was pretty legendary to be a part of that. You were already pretty gone when you invited us on, me and David, but we came and it was worth it. I think we went 2 hours after you called us on.
Yeah, you guys got in like near the end because we had done a 4 hour or yeah no 3 hour limit no 4 hour it was 4 hour limit, and I pushed it back when you guys got there because I didn't want it to end. We were having a good time, and I went back and I looked at the recording, and the final recording time was 5 hours 41 minutes.
Yeah,
and we were just on there, just it was a lot of fun. We got Liberty Lockdown on there, and you guys were on, you and Brian. I think the three of y'all went and did a podcast after that on Lions of Liberty, and I thought that was really cool. We had Olivia on there. It was just a hodgepodge of people.
Yeah.
And then Gabe Whitley, who's a friend of mine here in Indiana, he's, you know, big MAGA guy, got him on. You guys all saw his Trump flag and were like, what the fuck is that? Get out of here, man. Funny thing about that is, so that day, he invited me to a Trump caravan in Evansville, Indiana. And I was like, I'm going to fucking go to Trump caravan. I'm going to sit in my car and honk a bunch and say, hey, MAGA. Fuck that. I didn't even vote for Trump either time, dude. Like, fuck off. And I told him that. I'm like, I'm not going to your Trump caravan. So he was like one of the main organizers of it. And it pissed off people in his town. He had the FBI come visit him. Like three people said he was called the FBI and said he was at the Capitol on the 6th. He was like, what the fuck? It's like, I was in Evansville. I had to prove that I was in Evansville on the 6th to the FBI because the people were mad I made a line of cars. And that's the fucking scary. And I laughed at it at first, but like, that's scary. I was thinking about it. And because I, you know, I did that hashtag response to David last night about I was at the Capitol January 6th.
See, that was Eddie.
I'm just going to tempt fate on that one. But I was sitting there thinking, I have no way to prove I wasn't there. I'm like, I'm tweeting that whole day.
Yeah.
But like, I don't have my location on. You can't see where I'm tweeting. I'm like, oh, I'm fucked.
Dude, someone snapped a picture and there's someone who looks like just like me. I'll put it on Twitter or something. It is funny. Like, you zoom in and it does look a lot like me. And I have proof. I was in Idaho that day, pretty far from the Capitol. But it is. One of my friends sent it to me, and he's like, "I found you." I was like, "Oh no!" The guy's wearing sunglasses, so it you know, disguises. It makes it more possible that it looks like me than if he didn't. But it's unfortunate. So yeah, I guess I've I can't tweet stuff like out like that because then, you know, they'll find that picture and be like, oh yeah, he was there. And, you know, the Idaho stuff will be a fake alibi or something. But
yeah, my alibi is literally going to have to be, no, I was sitting on my couch during my lunch break playing video games. I don't know how I can prove that, but I can tell you I watched, no, I wasn't. That was the inauguration. Fuck. I don't know how I can prove that. I was sitting here watching it, though. I just remember just like, holy shit.
And well, I heard about it, I think through Twitter. Because I was driving and I stopped and I read a message in a group chat, like, they're storming the Capitol. So in my mind, I just pictured, like, I pictured them, like, storming in to execute politicians with guns and everything. I was like, oh, God, here we go. And then I got done driving for the night and I watched the footage and I was like, what? And I saw the pictures coming out like of the inside of the Capitol building and I was like, if this is an insurrection, our standards are getting pretty low. Yeah.
I think the raid on Harper's Ferry went a little bit harder than that. like this is the worst attack on our democracy since 9/11 or whatever. And it was like, dude, like, one cop died and it later came out that he wasn't even at the Capitol. And then one person died. And that actually, like, I'm still pretty pissed about that. Like, they literally, the state literally fucking murdered a woman who was just in there. And it was a show of force. I don't care what anyone says. That was the guy who pulled the trigger on that one did it because he knew if he dropped one person, they would all flee.
Yeah.
But like, and then you have people who weren't even there, like AOC, crying about it. Like, it was so terrible. And like, I'm pissed about AOC and multiple reasons. That's the Amash thing. But you have people like AOC and not Ilhan Omar, the other one, the squad member. She's like freaking out. And they're like, neither one of you were there. You have Thomas Massie in his office with an AR-15 discussing with his staff. All right, what are rules of engagement? It's just like, you got. That's a real legislator there. He didn't care about the state at that point. He was trying to defend he and his. And you're too busy crying at the other fucking site, like the other office. And that's the thing, fucking, I don't know, man. I will go on record saying I loved seeing politicians cowering in fear. I didn't want anyone hurt.
I did a video on that. People can go watch. I encourage any new subscribers to go back to, like, I don't know what episode number it'll be. It was a live stream I did for my truck, so it's not an episode, but just follow the episodes back to like January 6th and you can see, like, I'm doing a live video at least every other night during that time and you can see me talking about it and I was one of the few people saying, like, this is not an insurrection, this is stupid, this is nothing, and because everyone else was freaking out. And then the whole
videos of them moving the barricades too and just letting people walk in.
Well, dude, what pisses me off so much about libertarians, like libertarians, is so I was against Trump's impeachment both times, even though I thought he deserved to be impeached for other things, but they weren't, you know, they weren't going after any of his actual heinous crimes that he committed. I was against it both times because I was like, okay, if you impeach a president for something this fucking stupid, you don't think that's ever going to come back to bite you in the ass? Like, you don't think they're going to use that against you? And now you're seeing that with Nick Fuentes, you know, he's on the no-fly list, and a lot of libertarians were cheering about that. And I was like, what is wrong with you? Like, why are you cheering for political dissidents not being allowed to fly? And you don't have to like Nick Fuentes at all. You can think he's the worst human being that's ever walked the planet if you want. But they're just, they really think that the state is going to be on their side when they take over, or I don't know what their thought process is. Like, I don't either. So, like, it's so confusing. Like, but
Fuentes is a douche, but the worst thing they're going to do, like, what they're going to make him a martyr. That's not good. They're turning Fuentes into a martyr, and Fuentes is like the last person you should make into a martyr. God, I don't want a bunch of 20-year-old groypers having vigils of Nick Fuentes. That'd be the fucking worst thing to happen ever.
Yeah, well, I don't know. Like, he's completely, well, not completely, but he's pretty powerless. Like, he doesn't have that much power. Yeah. Like,
he doesn't have anywhere to stream anymore. Like, he's just like a fucking 21-year-old kid who lives in his parents' house in Chicago now. Like, yeah, he's got money and he's got a platform. He used to have a platform. I don't know if he does now. But all he focuses on is the culture war. And I'm sure there are things I would probably half agree with him on, but it's like a lot of it, like the not giving much of money to Israel. Like, that's the thing. I agree with him on that. I don't think we should be giving billions of dollars a year to Israel, but my reasoning behind it's probably a little bit different than his.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, yeah, we don't need to give American taxpayer money to any foreign nation, especially Israel, who we're giving so much and have all this technology and they've got nuclear weapons that everyone doesn't know about. Wink, wink. We don't need to help them. But also, we don't need to help anyone else. And he's just like, yeah, we don't need to help Israel because Jews. And it's just like, see, you lost me there, bud. You had me in that first half. And then you're like, no, sorry, man. I don't agree with you on that.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, have you? It's like, bro, have you even had a Reuben? Reubens are tasty. You really going to hate the Jews for that? Like,
yeah. I actually want to let's talk about AOC a little bit, just because I got a lot of heat on Twitter. So I have been a huge critic of hers for a long time, and it's not even for her, democratic socialist views, because I don't even think she is one. I think she's a fraud, and I've said that many times. Like, I think she's a corporate sellout hack. You know, she sheepdogs for the Democratic Party. She votes for all of their corporate spending bills. Like, she didn't vote against one of them. She claims she voted against the CARES Act, but it was after the fact, and I don't really believe her. And even if it was just a voice vote. Every time she's been recorded, she's voted for all these giant bloated corporate spending bills that don't help the middle class, that boost corporations. She's also voted for sanctions a bunch of times. And she's just like completely sold her soul if she ever had one. And she's a complete fraud. But I wasn't upset with Justin Amash for having her come speak to the class or whatever. And it was because, let me actually pull the tweet up just so I can make sure I read it right. It was because he didn't, let me see. And as you know, Twitter's not a place for nuance or thoughtful discussion. So can't even talk about it. But let's see, where is it? So he says, thanks so much to AOC for speaking with my students. She graciously answered every question and went into overtime with them. Libertarians and progressives can be great allies in the causes of decentralization and better governance. So the better governance part, like, I just cringed at, and I wouldn't have used decentralization because I don't think that's a good adjective for progressives, but he didn't say like AOC is a great representative who has been a principled progressive. Like, he says, thank you for coming to speak to my class. And then he says, libertarians and progressives can be great allies, which I agree with. And I think she's a fucking useless sellout bitch, but I'm glad that he talked with her, because she still has a huge audience of people who aren't hack sellout bitches. They just don't know that she is. So I think the dialogue is good. Like, I think it's good that he's talking to her, just because that will influence a lot of people to be open to talking to libertarians, hopefully. What did you think, though? Because it was a very divisive topic.
I thought it was, I hate to use the terms because they're sitting so fucking stupid. I thought it was blue-pilled as hell of him to do it, but mainly not for the reasons that most people were pissed about it. I don't really have a problem with him creating a dialogue with AOC, mainly because I think maybe it would do her some good. I don't think it would do anyone else some good, personally, to listen to her fucking grovel and talk about how much she cares about people and doesn't in reality.
Right.
She's a typical politician. I didn't like his wording of that tweet. I think it was like the better governance thing. I was like, dude, fuck off. Like,
well, I agree with you there.
I think the only thing I really officially came out said, and when I quote tweeted him, I was like, are these the same progressives who want to, you know, and everything's in the terms of guns for me anymore. I was like, oh yeah, better governance and small government. Yeah, let's take all the guns away, right? Let's build a big government database of people who own guns, right? That's small government. That's better governance, right? Yeah. Okay, cool. Those are the progressives. And I probably should have put quotations around progressives because I agree. You said something about she's not really a progressive.
I don't think she is.
Like, I don't think a lot of the people who call themselves are progressives are progressives.
Well, I think Dennis Kucinich was a progressive. Like, he's the only really principled one that I can think of recently that was in office. But like, it's weird. Like, a lot of people have a lot of respect for Dennis Kucinich because Ron Paul worked him a lot, but he is like as anti-gun as you can get. And he's not a shrink the state guy. He's just shrink parts of the state, you know, like they think that, but I mean, I respect Dennis Kucinich, and I think it's great that he and Ron Paul did a lot of stuff together. You know, I like it when like Tulsi Gabbard and Thomas Massie did a lot of stuff together. Like that type of, I want to see more of that type of thing, because I think we build up these walls that progressive are evil. And I don't, you know, I think AOC is evil. And I also think like Ted Cruz is evil. Like, I think pretty much every politician in Washington is evil. But I don't think that dialogue between progressives and libertarians is a bad thing. I think it's actually a good thing, because that actually opens a door for us to influence them. Because a lot of, you know, I don't know, it's weird. I understand why a lot of libertarians are talking to Trump supporters now, because I agree, like, now it makes sense because Trump lost and these Trump supporters are floundering around and they don't know what to do. In 2020, I was talking to a lot of progressives because they were fucked. Like, their candidate lost. They had Joe Biden and they didn't know where to go. So I was trying, and I wasn't doing bullshit virtue signaling. I was talking to them about issues and things. And there is a lot of crossover. I'd say like it's kind of equal to the conservatives. I mean, like if you're talking to a really good progressive who really cares about people, you know, they want to end all the wars, they want to end the war on drugs, they want to end the Patriot Act, they don't want torture, they want to get rid of Guantanamo Bay, they want immigration reform, you know, a lot of stuff we want that the Republicans would never give us. So I'm disheartened to see this huge affront to trying to talk to the left. Like, I don't think the left is any more evil than the right. I just think they're winning right now. I mean, we've seen what the right is like when they're in charge too, 20 years ago. And I don't know, they weren't any better to us. You know, we were traitors and terrorist sympathizers, and you know, so I don't know. What do you think though?
I think it's important to have dialogue. So I would agree with you on that. I didn't agree with the bringing the Bernie people in 2020. I still don't, mainly because I think you're going to get the wrong people to come.
Well, what do you mean? I think there's a difference between bringing in and having dialogue.
I was going to get to that. Okay. There was a lot of people in 2020, I guess I need to rephrase it better, that were trying to be like, Bernie bros, we accept you with open arms, you guys feel so disenfranchised, who just vote for our people, learn about what we do. And I think you're going to, that's you got to be careful with that. You can have a dialogue. I think having a dialogue is important. Talk about what you stand for and then be like, do you guys want to join up with us, instead of being like, hey, come vote for our guy, join up with us, and then we can just figure out the ideology later. I think that goes the same with the MAGA people now.
Yeah, right.
You don't just be like, hey, I know you guys are really pissed off about what happened with Trump. The Republicans aren't doing enough for you. There's a lot of people who feel that way. Join us and we'll get it all figured out later. And I think there are, and there's going to be people who say, well, that's not what we're doing. There's a lot of people who that's what they did last year. And I think there's going to be people on the right side of libertarianism that do that this year. It's all about growing numbers to them and less about having a discussion. I think it's okay to have discussions with people. I think it's important to have discussions with people. Amash having a discussion with AOC is not the reason why I didn't like what happened yesterday. It was, like I said, it was just kind of the way he worded it. And I just, another example of him just, I don't know, frustrating.
Just not messaging the way you'd want him to. I get that. I mean, he does that occasionally. That particular tweet didn't really bug me that much. It did a little bit, but he made one a few weeks ago that I was just like, what? I forget what it was, but he does occasionally hit us with a tweet that's just like, dude, no, just don't say that. Just, you're better off.
Yeah.
Anything. But
it's a sad reality of what he's become of. It's just, I think he doesn't know what to do. And I think a lot of what he does now is try to work like tool ideas, like talking to AOC. And in reality, that's a pretty good idea. Let's have a discussion with AOC, with people like-minded. Like-minded with him, let's have a discussion with AOC because he has those connections. Let's use him, right? But a lot of the time, I think he just wants to make a soundbite or a written soundbite. Just continue to be relevant. That's a reality. I understand that.
I think the problem with him is that he's not as neutral as he wants to be. You know, like he's or he wants to think he is. Like he would not have, I don't know. Like he wouldn't have some conservative guy from Congress come talk about taxes or something, you know, like, yeah. I don't think he would. I mean, not someone who was like a Trump guy or something, like he wouldn't do that. So, I mean, I would have anyone on this show, like I made a tweet about this and it made a lot of people angry too. I said, like, I'd have AOC on, I'd have Nick Fuentes on, I'd have friggin' Liz Cheney on if she wanted to come on. Like, I don't care. I'd talk to anybody. And I said, I'd even have someone from Al-Qaeda on. I just kind of added that on just to,
well, you know, the thing is like you want to have diverse ideas on, you, no matter if it's your show, Tucker Carlson, CNN, I don't give a shit who it is, because it breaks your echo chamber. If you just listen to libertarian podcasters all day who do nothing but talk to libertarians all day, it's just like after the same point, what the fuck are they saying that's any different than the other guy?
Right. I mean, like, that's kind of what I like at this point.
but you're attempting to diversify, like. I guarantee you my ideology is different than Shane Hazel, who you had on. I'm sure we agree on a lot of stuff, but I'm sure there's a lot of nuance and difference. Right. Josh's show, I like his show. I think it's a cool setup of how he does it. But like I watched a couple episodes back to back, and I just kind of turned it off after a while because I was like, dude, I know what you're doing, and you're bringing in the big libertarian names, and you're building your brand. But after a certain while, it's just kind of like, let's diversify a little bit, man. Like, I want you to have someone who you're not going to agree with on everything because it'll make for an interesting dialogue. Go grab a neocon that's big on Twitter. Ask him on your show. What's it going to hurt? He's probably just going to get mad and spurg out on you and tell you about why we need to bomb Afghanistan into fucking glass. But it just makes him look like a jackass.
Yeah.
And that goes for any libertarian podcaster or YouTuber. And I don't mean to pick on Joshua by any means. I love what he's doing, but it's just like, it's important too, to diversify your dialogue. And I think and that goes for Amash's thing. I think that's important to do. And I commend him for trying to have that dialogue. I just think his messaging could have been different is really my ultimate point. To use my millennial slang, don't simp for them just because they came on your show, man, or came and talked to your students or whatever. You still, you know, call a spade a spade. You can still be critical of people you talk to, but also be happy they came and talked and have a dialogue. So.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, Tom Woods kind of said it well the other day when he was on my show, like, meet people where they are, but then try to bring them closer. You know, if you just meet them where they are, then what good have you done? Like, you haven't changed them at all. Try to show them your humanity and your similarity. But then after that, you've got to do something with that or you're useless. You know, like it's that's kind of the goal, is to push people in the right direction. You know, I was able to do that with a lot of former Tulsi supporters. I was able to make them into, you know, libertarians. Some of them like literally became libertarians, other than just moved in that direction. Like that's the goal. Like if I just met them where I was and was like, Hey, we agree on this and this and this. Cool. Isn't that great? And then we clap hands and move on. You know, who cares? Like what matters is if you've actually done something and pushed them in the right direction.
I agree. And that's a way to do it. Well, I think I got to get going. I got someone blowing my phone up. They're trying to get a hold of me. So okay. Politics never dies, my friend. But yeah. I appreciate you having me on, having our own little conversation. We should do this again. It's a lot of fun. Not that I don't like David, but
yeah,
it's easier to have a one-on-one conversation than a three-person conversation, because not everyone gets to say what they want to say, and that goes for everybody, not even just me. But yeah. I really appreciate you having me on again. Look forward to doing it again. Yeah, just if you got it real quick, do you mind if I plug something?
Yeah, go for it.
So NAGR, National Association for Gun Rights, just started their own podcast of their own. It's called Tap Rack Bang. It's over on their YouTube channel. The guys on the show, they're part of our federal team. They're going to talk a lot about gun politics and stuff that's going on right now. And it's going to be a lot of fun. I just kind of remembered that. I thought I would throw that out there. So if you like guns, I know you do, Reed, you might want to check it out. Maybe I can call in a favor or two.
All right. Yeah. Well, I got your Twitter bio linked in the description so people can go follow you there. And yeah, it was good, Will. I am going to be live streaming, let's see, tomorrow and then Sunday. And then I'll be taking pretty much the whole week off. But the following Sunday, we're going to have Eric Jackman, Ryan Dawson, and Dave Smith all on at the same time. So make sure you guys stay tuned for that. It's going to be 8 o'clock p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Sunday the 16th. That one's going to be wild. Probably my biggest show I've ever done. So make sure you stay tuned for that.